Nou ja, ons kuier heerlik saam hier op die senders van 'n Radio Kansel en Kaapse Kansel. Baie baie dankie dat jy ingeskakel is. Dis 'n groot voorreg dat ons tyd met mekaar kan deurbring en ek vertrou dat ook hierdie program vir jou geweldig, sommer baie baie gaan bemoedig, want dit is 'n absolute uitsonderlike getuienis waarna jy vandag gaan luister. Miskien het jy ietsie daarvan raak gelees in die media, maar hier hoor ons ook die man en die stem en die ervaring en die emosie en alles wat deel is van daardie pakket en ek is baie baie dankbaar dat ons dit met mekaar kan deel. Ek herinner dat ook hierdie program natuurlik as 'n potgooi beskikbaar is by www.radiokansel.co.za en jy kan natuurlik dan net na 'n naweek aktueel toe gaan en daar kan jy dit weer 'n keer luister of met mense deel. En die afgelope week se aktualiteitsprogram nê, op Woensdag het gehandel oor die Freedom Charter en ons het gesels oor woede en ons het met 'n klomp ander dinge gesels. So dit is ook beskikbaar as 'n potgooi as jy 'n bietjie daarna sou wou luister. So nogmaals baie baie dankie en ook aan Sani wat vir ons die tegniese versorging behartig. Nou, ek is baie bevoorreg om 'n vriend, 'n kollega of dan 'n broer hierby en my in die ateljee te verwelkom. And I'm really very, very happy that I can welcome Rusty Labuschagne. And Rusty has had an experience that I cannot even imagine one can have and still be on the other side of that experience alive to tell the story. Nevertheless, we'll get to that story, but for the moment, Rusty, thank you so much for joining us. This is Rusty Labuschagne.
Thank you, Yanni, and thanks for having me on, and apologies for Labuschagne talking English.
No problem, we're totally bilingual. Actually, we broadcast in most of the languages in South Africa, but when I saw your surname, that's why I inquired, and I said, is hierdie 'n Afrikaanse Labuschagne? But then you said, no, wait a minute, this is an English Labuschagne, but just very, very welcome. We're going to talk about your incarceration in prison in Zimbabwe, and I have some questions and would like to learn from you, and our listeners would like to learn from you and hear how you survived that ordeal. But let's start right at the very beginning, Rusty. Tell us about your upbringing. Where did you grow up? And something of that background, please.
Thank you, Yanni. I'm actually French Huguenot stock. And my ancestors, settled in the Cape between 1688 and 1691. And then in 1913, my great-grandfather trekked from Dar in the Northern Cape to a little place called West Nicholson in southern Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. And that's where my life started, from humble beginnings as a fourth generation Zimbabwean in a cattle ranching background. And I was sent to boarding school at 6 years old, 200 k's away.
Sure.
And in those days, you can imagine a little six-year-old boy 200 k's away, and the terms were three months long, and you were only allowed to see your folks once every term, and that was at half term. Even if they came to town, you couldn't see them. It was supposed to upset the child. That's the old colonial rules, you know. Anyway, I didn't have good memories of my junior school days. Then I tragically lost my charismatic father at the tender age of 12, which turned our lives upside down. And then endured the wild ways of the Rhodesian Bush War, Yanni. And being crazy about rugby and water polo and the war environment created a wild, hardy character. They were rough times. And I'm telling you this, Yanni, because I believe that resilience is something that you learn. You're not born with resilience.
Yeah.
You're born with fortitude. And I think my hard times in boarding school and the war environment and the rugby and everything stood me on good ground for my time when I went away. Anyway, I left school. I was always very passionate about sport and very fortunate to play several rugby tests for Zimbabwe, which I loved. But I was, I'm a country boy and I like to be in the bush, you know. So yes. I started in the safari industry in the beginning of 82. And after a few years, I realized that I could make as much money as these guys I'm working for by getting a few clients for myself.
Yes.
And I was in the hunting business, hunting safaris. And so a partner and I did that. And soon, after 1 year, we did so well that we split up and I went on my own. And I was fishing safaris, photographic and hunting, but primarily hunting. And it was so successful, Yanni, that by 2000, I was flying my own aircraft. I had a very lush place in Bulawayo, 5 safari concessions, fishing resort on Lake Kariba, water well drilling business. And yeah, I was doing well. I worked very hard. I had a great crew. And in 2000, that's when things all went wrong.
Sure, Rusty, thank you for sharing the background. And as you said, just referring to your childhood years, in a sense, it must have prepared you for what lied ahead. By God's grace, we don't know what the road what the road entails for us in the future. But then you said you referred to the year 2000, and you were exactly busy with what you have just described within the business environment that you have been that you found yourself in. And then something happened that led to your imprisonment there in Zimbabwe in a jail. What happened?
Yanni, every safari operator, whether you are fishing, hunting, or photographic, you're responsible for the anti-poaching on any of the concessions that you're on, mostly because they're remote areas. I had an ongoing battle with the fish poachers in the area where my fishing resort was, because it was a breeding area, a non-netting area. You could fish with a rod and reel, but you couldn't net fish there.
And
we were non-consumptive, so we were mainly catch and release, just eat whatever you want to eat in the camp. And I had run-ins with some poachers there. And one afternoon, I was on a trip with a bunch of mates of mine, and we were all fishing for bream in the river of the Sinamwenda. And a mate of mine and I decided to go tiger fishing on the lake. And on our way back, we spotted 2 fish poachers in a steel boat, who immediately, upon seeing us, started paddling hastily for the shore in an effort to get away from us.
Yes, yes.
And knowing they were notorious poachers, I knew them, I drove my boat towards them to scare them off. And the wake of my boat tilted their boat, causing them to jump out into the water. And they were about 3 meters from the shore, and it was about 1.5 meters deep. They soon scrambled to dry land. And my mate and I then watched as they ran away into the bush and thought nothing more of it. The following day, the police arrived with one of the poachers and accused us of drowning the other one. And to cut a long story short, Johnny, without a body, against police evidence and on presumptions, I was convicted of drowning that poacher. There was a great deal of political interference. It got very ugly. There was a judge imprisoned. It got to presidential level, and it's another whole story that's all in my book. But the injustice of it all, when such a little time was spent in the trial proving somebody died or somebody drowned, because there's no evidence.
Yes.
All they wanted to pin was that I had drowned somebody, and all contradicting evidence. So it was very, very tough. It was very, very hard to process it all, especially lying in prison. You've been given 15 years and you're serving 10. A lot of stuff goes through your head in those years.
Rusty, I can't even imagine. Now, your colleague that was with you in the boat, just as a matter of interest, what happened to him? And was he also imprisoned, or they were only interested in you?
You won't believe it, Yanni. He got a $10 fine and was set free because he was not driving the boat. And that is exactly as it is in the judgment, because he was not driving the boat. It's unbelievable.
We'll refer to the book towards the end of the program and encourage listeners also to get hold of it. And unfortunately, I haven't read it yet, but just listening to you, this must have been an experience I can't even, as I've already said, I can't even imagine going through an experience like that. Now, during the, I was just thinking about the court proceedings. Were you able or weren't you able to make an appeal to people to appear on your behalf, friends or attorneys or, you know, some kind of legal advice and people that would have been there and said, but this is not reasonable and this is not justifiable the way that the law has been interpreted in that situation?
The only one thing that I knew from the beginning, so my lawyer said it'll never get to court. There's no evidence, nothing. And then it started getting political interference from the 2000. Not many people understand what the land invasion like atmosphere was like in the country at that time. The injustice spread everywhere. From people not paying rent because they felt entitled. And that was the whole thing. Everyone was made to believe they were entitled because the elections are coming up and they needed votes. That was the whole land invasion chaos. And it just led to lawlessness countrywide. And that was during the time from my incident was in December 2000. The land invasion started in early 2000. So by the time the incident took place, it was rife. I mean, it was walking into supermarkets and just taking over the supermarket. Anyway, by the time the trial came, I had a judge assigned to my trial. That was my judge in my divorce 1 month prior to that.
Yes, yes.
The judgment was against me, saying I never held the court in high esteem.
Yes.
Because I didn't agree with what they did. And that went to Supreme Court and was overturned in my favor. But nevertheless, if someone is presiding over an important case like murder, when he's already got an opinion of you.
Correct.
And then during the whole trial, it was just, you know, it was just gunning me. The prosecutor asked me 11 questions. The judges and assessors asked me, I think, 52 questions. And it was just going at me the whole time. And I remember walking one lunchtime during the trial because they had me for several days. And my lawyer said, I don't know what it is, but they just seem to be going for you. You know, every time there's something against you, they write in a red pen, it's something for you, it's all in blue. And then he said something that really startled me. And he said, you know, that assessor, I helped him and he really owes me one. And I'm thinking, am I just a part of this favor thing that they run or whatever? You know, so
yes.
I learned now when I got to prison how corrupt our whole system is because all the armed robbers tell you when you get to prison. But, and then my appeal was the same thing, Yanni. They just put the Chief Justice there and they're all bought. So yeah, there's nothing. And I got a good advocate, Chris Anderson. And he came to see me afterwards and he just said, they didn't listen to you one thing I said. Nothing.
Yeah.
The prosecutor, his words were something to this effect. He said, I think when you look at the overall aspects of this trial, the sentence and the judgment need to be looked at very carefully. And the judge has never changed one thing.
Yeah, those first days when you realized, but this is not going to change. This probably is going to be my home for the next couple of years. At that time, it was 15 years. Can you recall, and I don't even know whether I want to take you there, but I suppose it's something that you do not forget. It's become part of your DNA, and it can't just be wiped out from your existence and from your memory. Those first days when you realize, but listen, it's not going to change, that must have been very, very difficult.
Yes, it was, Yanni. It was. You know, it's obviously the immediate shock. I never believed I'd go to prison, although I was warned before, 3 days before, by a mate of mine that was quite connected. And he said, no, Russ, you need to get out of the country. You're going to prison. And, you know, just for the audience, Yanni, we don't value our word enough and our reputation. Yes. So I was told I was leaving, that I was going to prison. And had I run, I would have been guilty. That's the first thing. You leave your family, all your friends, everything you've worked 20 years for your whole life. And you never stop running.
Yes.
And for me, Yanni, it was more about my reputation, my word. And that hasn't changed. And just for guys that are making decisions like that, stick to the truth. Because in the end, it'll come through for you. And I look at the big picture of it all, Yanni, where I started in my life, very successful and what I went through. And I'll go through that. But how the Lord had his hand on me the whole time. And how, I mean, Yanni, I was wild. I mean, I was a rugby player, you know, just drinking and enjoying that, you know, in the war, it develops a wild character. And that's how we were. We were okay. We didn't need help. Only those that go to church need help, go to church and pray. You know, that's how we were until I got to prison, until I had to get on my knees. And I'll give you a story about that. But my life changed in prison. Yeah. But I was doing a talk one day, Yanni. It was very moving. In not long ago in Oudtshoorn.
Yes.
And it was a public talk. And afterwards, there were a group of youngsters that came and wanted to have a chat. And there were two young ladies with their boyfriends. And they said, can we ask you some questions? So I said, yeah. And one of the girls said, while you were talking, because I've got a PowerPoint presentation.
Yes, yes.
She said there was a dove on the corner of every slide. And she prayed while I was talking to ask the Lord what that was.
Yes.
And she very clearly was told, tell him I was with him all the way through.
Sure, yeah.
It was so moving. And when I talk about it now, it's moving for me. Because I never knew the Lord back then. Yeah. And I had to go to that place. And I'll tell you the incident that happened, Yanni, when we get there. Because... Yeah. I'm running off the what it's like when you go in there. I mean, Yanni, when you put in handcuffs and leg irons and you are somebody in society, you know, I became successful from nothing. I wasn't a no one. Yes. It is so humiliating on Main Street during rush hour. They plan it just nice. To break you, Yanni, to crush you. Yeah. And when you go in there, flying high, full of confidence, lots of money, your spirits are high. They break you. They break your confidence, your spirit, they crush you. And no matter who you are when you come out, it's very hard to pick up the pieces. But when I went in, Yanni, the other thing is, so you arrive at the prison, and the first thing you do, you register and all that stuff at the offices. And then you walk to an area where you remove all your clothes, everything. And you walk across a little courtyard to the maximum security exercise yard.
Yes.
And there's big doors. And you start naked and you're escorted by two prison guards in there. There were 1,000 guys in there.
Yes.
And I was the only white guy. It was unbelievably terrifying. Something that, I mean, take the worst thing you can imagine and multiply it by 10. That's what it felt like. And then, I mean, the noise and the smell. I mean, you know, those prisons are old and they're so run down. And I got to my cell. The cell was 13 meters long by 3 meters wide. We were 79 guys in there. 79 guys in that 13 meters by 3 meters. And so obviously when you lie down across the 3 meters, all your legs cross over in the middle. So on the walls were 13 inches, 33 centimeters, marked out on the walls in chalk, all the way along the wall. That was your space.
That was your space.
Centimeters. It wasn't only not allowed, but you couldn't lie on your back. You had to lie on your side. And you all lay on your sides, packed like sardines, with your legs all crossing over in the middle, and you all faced the same direction.
Yes,
when you turned over, it was all together. And as cushioning against the cold concrete floor, you'd fold two of your paper-thin, worn-out, lycidin blankets several times to fit your space, your 33 centimeters, then cover yourself with a third one. And the lice, Yanni, you know, I've never seen lice before. There were lice, thousands and thousands of lice, and they just bit you night and day. And you know, we, as men, we can go through tough times. I mean, I'll get to other hardships, but lice was the worst for me because they never stopped. Day and night. It's like mosquitoes that are in your clothes, in your blankets, in your hair that bite you day and night, year after draining year. It just, it eats away at you on every level. But life's so tough. And then, Yanni, we were only ever allowed one set of clothing at any one time. Underwear was forbidden. And that was a short sleeve white shirt and a pair of drawstring white shorts. After 6 months, you got a change of clothing. And they would take the old ones away because guys would sell the new ones for cigarettes. They were so desperate, and keep the old ones. They'd sell the new ones.
Sure.
And yeah. And then there were no basins or taps in the cells, and we only had one set of clothing. So we had to wash our clothes in the cell toilets at night wearing a blanket, then hang them on the walls with smuggled book staples to dry by the next morning. And if, you know, just to give the audience an idea of what the prison looks like, Yanni, it's, there's no furniture whatsoever in a prison. There's no beds, tables, chairs, cupboards, nothing. Not even a mirror. I didn't see my face for the first 8 years. It's just rows of filthy folded blankets and hundreds of well-used water bottles on bare concrete floors. So to add to that, Yanni, in 2005, during the Zimbabwe dollar crash, Harare City ran out of water. For 3 years, while in Chikurubi Maximum Security Prison, each prisoner was allocated only one plastic cup of water a day, one cup of dirty orange city runoff water from a nearby dam carried by farm prisoners. That was to drink, clean your teeth, wash your face, bath, everything for 3 years, Yanni, 3 years. And that's when guys really started dying. And I'll get to that part, Yanni, because the Zimbabwe, during the Zimbabwe dollar crash and the land invasions, the starvation started.
Yeah.
So there was, I learned that the most important things in life cannot be bought. Mm-hmm. Health,
yes.
Loved ones, and friends, in that order. Yeah. In my first 6 years, Yanni, I watched over 2,200 people die. Primarily from malnutrition. It was during the Zimbabwe dollar crash when there was no food outside of prison, never mind in the prison. It was unbelievable.
So, Rusty, yes, and I really want to get to what changed you and and the role that God and your faith played, but I'm interested to hear whether there was there any way, or wasn't there any way, that you could appeal to the international community? Were they aware of what's happening there? Because I cannot even imagine, just taking modern-day atrocities, things that are happening in Ukraine, for instance, and Russia and the invasion and people being killed and executed and all of that, there's an outcry from the international community. Did you appeal to these people? Was there any favor? Or I can't even imagine. Yes.
And during one of the visits, I asked my fiance to ask my lawyer to come and see me.
Yes.
The black guy was connected, so it wasn't a racial thing. So he could reach the places, the right people. And I said to him, his name was Jumbo. I said, Jumbo, is there no prison protocol, no laws?
You know, yes.
He said, Russ, in Zimbabwe, there's no rights in prison. You have no rights. You belong to the state, and the state owns you. They'll control what you eat, drink, read, write, hear, say, wear, everything. They control everything. And he said, nobody is allowed in here. And I know, because I was there. No one, you don't see anyone, not Red Cross, not nobody. Until they started dying to the extent they were. And in March 2009, Red Cross took over feeding. And unbelievably, Yanni, so the weekend before Red Cross came, 11 guys died in 3 days. After the Red Cross took over, they brought this stuff they called Plumpy Nut, like a toffee, and they handed it out to everybody. Within 1 month, that was in March 2009. In April, one guy died. After that, not one. And they were dying by the hundreds, Yanni. When I was moved to Harare Central Prison, Harare Central, there were 1,200 of us. In 8 months, out of that 1,200, 432 guys died. That's more than one third of us in 8 months. It was unbelievable. And nobody said a word. No one.
You're listening to the programs of Radio Pulpit and Cape Pulpit. My guest is Rusty Labuschagne. We're talking about this incredible experience that he's had. 10 years being imprisoned unlawfully in Zimbabwe, and the inhumane circumstances in which he was kept there. Rusty, somewhere along the line, you had to make a choice. You had to make a decision and say, listen, if I'm going to survive this ordeal, I will have to reprogram, in a sense, myself. Tell us about that. What happened, and how did you manage to do that, and how did you fight off the depression and the sadness and the rejection and the anger that you must have felt at that particular time?
Danny, you know, when you go in there are a lot of questions you ask yourself. Why me? What have I ever done to deserve this? Is this real? Do these guys all feel the pain I'm feeling? Am I dreaming and I'm going to wake up? You know, it's like you can't take it in. And then I thought, well, maybe I've been put up to be protected. And I was doing a lot of business deals, and some of them with what you guys high up, and you know, stuff was happening during the land invasions that was a lot of lawlessness. And then I thought, you know, I always told my kids that everything happens for a good reason. Yeah. And now I have to walk my talk. And that's the only way I could get through there, Yanni, is to tell myself, there's got to be a reason for this.
Yes.
And my faith had been tested a lot along the way, Yanni. I prayed like crazy in the courthouse, and nothing changed. I prayed for a year, my first year to go home, nothing changed. And then in my first year, and I remember it as clear as anything, Yanni. I was walking in the exercise yard, and I was tired of all the anger, hatred, and bitterness. I mean, I hated them like you can't believe. And I'd planned everything for every one of them with the revenge and anger. But I looked up, and I just said to myself, I said, Lord, take care of them, and let me get through this road that's been put in front of me. What goes around comes around. They'll get what they deserve. They will get their judgment. And once I'd accepted that the Lord is going to take care of that, it was a huge weight off my shoulders. And the amazing thing, Yanni, it wasn't a gradual feeling.
Yes,
it was an instant, like I'd been holding a secret for years and years and worried about everyone finding out. And then one day I just decided I'm going to tell the Oaks, and it was out. It was like, it's gone. I can't control it. God's going to take care of that. Finished.
Yeah.
But after that, Yanni, people were dying like crazy. There was no food. There was no water. I mean, one guy dying at my feet one night, I was the only one trying to help him. And you know, when someone dies in your cell, when you're trying to help him, it leaves something in you. And it happened over and over. And then my fiance left me. So the years that followed that, because there was a spiritual element in that forgiveness that day in my first year. But for 3 or 4 years, nothing changed. In my seventh year, I was moved to a medium security prison in my eighth year. My sister, in 2006, the prison headquarters started allowing relatives to deliver food to their loved ones daily because the guys were dying so badly. And my sister, when you go to a medium security prison, it's very much more relaxed security-wise, so that you're not locked up for 20 hours a day. We were locked up for 20 hours a day in Chikurubi in a maximum security. So now we had 16 hours a day locked up. So it was much more relaxed, and 20 foot walls and the barbed wire, and it just didn't feel like a fort anymore.
Yes.
And then when my sister would bring food every day, the guards would say to her, you know, if he needs anything, just let us know, and then you give me something and I'll take it in for him.
Yeah.
So she came to the visitors thing, and there were lots of people talking, and she said, do you want an iPod? So I said to her, what's an iPod? She said, it's a thing that plays music. Well, how big is it?
Yes.
And she indicated this small, flat little thing. So I said, well, how many songs does it play? She said, oh, about 1,000. I said, no ways.
Yeah.
Where do you put all the CDs? That's how much technology had advanced in just 6 years I've been away. Anyway, the following day, the iPod arrived under the salad. And then about a week later, a cell phone was sneaked in too. One of those Nokia stupid things with the batteries. And the guards would charge them for us. And it was exciting, risky business that you couldn't dream of in a maximum security prison. And everything was going perfectly until an envious prisoner reported me. After an unexpected search from HQ, nothing was discovered through some quick maneuvering with Ansar's guards. But I was sent to solitary confinement anyway for 2 years. That was extremely lonely. But after experiencing that precious little link to the outside world, I had to get my phone back. And I did, which made a huge difference. 18 months later, Yanni, everything going perfectly. One of the friendly guards approached my file at 5 a.m. and whispered, "Russ, they're coming for your phone." And there's no way of getting a phone out of there. But someone had brought me a protein powder about a month before. And yes. I'd never seen it before. It went through, I had to go through the doctor and security, a big story to get it in. And when I got it, I opened it and broke its silver seal and tasted it and closed it, put the seal back, closed it. When I opened it again, the seal had stuck. So I thought, no, I'm going to hide my phone in there. So I broke the seal, took half the powder out, wrapped the phone in plastic, put it in, put the powder, put the seal. 6 o'clock, the guards arrive. And what they do is they make you strip naked, then you jump with your legs open like you're hiding something. And then you all walk out stark naked into the courtyard and they do the search. And after the search, I come back in. Everything is upside down everywhere, but my protein powder is still in good shape. The spirits are all high. 5 minutes later, I'm summoned to the security office. I walk in there. There are 4 guards standing, one seated behind a desk and an empty chair. I hadn't sat in a chair for 7.5 years. And he says to me, "Take a seat." So I knew something was up. I sat down, which felt good. He said, "Do you have a girlfriend called Karen?" So I said, "No." I said, "I had one before prison called Karen." He said, "Okay, when did you last talk to her?" I said, "Long ago, before prison." He said, "You sure?" I said, "Yeah." So he hands me a letter addressed to me from Karen. "So now talking to you on the phone the other night, you sound so positive."
Yeah.
After some intense questioning, this thought just came to me and I said, "No, Karen was having lunch in Bulawayo and she met a lady and they started chatting and then soon realized that they both had boyfriends in the same prison." So the lady called a boyfriend and he called me and we both had a chat. So I used the guard's phone. But after I couldn't tell them what the guard's name was, they didn't buy it. An hour later, I'm escorted up to the officer in charge's office. When you go up there, it's big trouble. And they were waiting, like 15 big brass officers staying in a half circle, officer in charge behind his big desk and my empty chair in the middle. He said, "Take a seat." And him and I got on really well. He said, "If you don't tell me what that guard's name is, your life in this prison is going to change." And yes. I said, "Officer, I don't know his name." And then the question started. How tall was he? How old? What rank? Where did you make the call? How long ago did you make the call? And I answered the best I could. Then the head of the SOCA said, "You want to talk to the officer in charge on your own?" So I said, "Yes, please." So they all leave, close the door. I said, "Officer, we've both been through hell. We've watched hundreds of guys die. I've donated endless stuff to the prison service. And, they were doing all kinds of illegal things." I said, "Can't you just let this one go?" He said, "Russ, I don't care about you, but I want that guard's name now." He was angry. And I said, "Officer, I don't know his name." So he said, "Okay." He calls the officers. They put him on death row in the dark cell. So they escorted me over to the condemned section. I used to hang out in those days. And there were 56 cells, if I remember correctly, and there were 54 full, 3 empty cells. One was a dark cell. The cells were 3 meters long by 1 meter wide, same as my solitary, and a vent. But the only vent in that dark cell was covered by a staircase, and the electric light didn't work. Then they used to use it to punish people, to break them.
Yes.
They made me strip naked. Gave me 3 worn-out lycerin blankets, a 5-liter container cut off at the top as a toilet, same as my solitary, and a liter of water. They locked me in there for 23 hours and 45 minutes a day. So I was allowed out 5 minutes in the morning to clean my teeth, 5 minutes at 10 o'clock to have a shower, 5 minutes at 3 o'clock to prepare for lockup. It was cold, lonely, and dark, like being buried alive, Yanni. Desperate on day 6. That's how hard I'd become. I got on my knees and I prayed. And I'll never forget the feeling of like warm water being poured over me and a total sense of calmness. So I sat down on the floor, leaning against the wall. Within 30 minutes, I faintly heard my Afrikaans mate shouting from the soccer ground, "Hey, Russ, everything's okay, my mate. Don't worry. Everything's okay." So I jumped up. I said, "Hey, fool." I said, "Don't worry, Russ. Everything's okay." So I thought, okay. Lay down on the concrete, looking up at the darkness. Within 10 minutes, I unlock my door. Cracker, and there's locks. So the noise goes right through you. Checking my clothes. Said the officer in charge wants to see you. So I go out into the blinding sun, across the courtyard, up the stairs to his office. And his exact words were, he said, "Hello, Russ." I said, "Hello, officer." He said, "Have you remembered the girl's name yet?" I said, "No, officer." He said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave it in God's hands. You can go back to your cell." And at the exact moment I was praying, my sister was paying him $200 to get me out of there. And that was a huge turning point in my spiritual life, Yanni. And I'm happy to say that I walk with Jesus every minute of every day today. It was a huge revelation. And after that, Yanni, you know, it was another 2.5 years in prison. And I never had any revelation or any indication that the Lord was still there. But when I look back on my life, you know, I was a big fish in a little pool going nowhere, like a hamster on a wheel going round and round. And it was all about me and my money, my empire. And now, Yanni, it's about helping others. I now have a purpose. And now I'm a big fish in a little fish in a whole wide world, making a huge difference. And I know 100%, Yanni, that the God has mapped out my life to give me the tools to work for Him. Because I'm going into full-time ministry. I want to make a difference in the calling. I want to bring people to the Lord because I've been there, Yanni. I've lived the high life. I've been through hell. And I have the tools to draw people to what the Lord's done for me. And we pray every day. And I've realized the power of our words, the power of prayer, the power of quiet time. You know, all these things I never had time for. I never had time for anyone or anything except the money and another car and another houseboat. And the Lord has brought me peace, Yanni, that I can't explain to anybody. You know, those big things, new car, new house, new this, they don't bring you peace. But when you find the Lord, that peace, you can't explain that to anyone. And the feeling of serving and helping others is something, Yanni, and I believe that the Lord has chosen me for this mission because I can reach the dry places that normal pastors and evangelists can't because I've mixed with those billionaires in America. And many of them, I still have their contacts. I've spoken in my motivational speaking. I've been doing it for 6 years. I've spoken to all these big guys. They're all lost, Yanni. They're all lost. They're all in that numbers, money, go, go, go. There's no time for the Lord. And I'm in the place, Yanni, because I'm close to them, to reach them and tell them what the Lord is all about. And I know that I know that I know that the Lord has redeemed me and He's going to use me because I'm a better person now than I would ever have been had I not gone to prison. And I thank God for my 10 years in prison, Yanni, because I'm a better person. I understand people more and I believe that God has made me able to reach out to tell people that God is out there. He's got a plan for you. He loves you. And if you walk with Him every day, He'll put your feet back on the ground. He'll give you what you want. Put your faith in Jesus and walk with Him every day. I've learned it and I've lived it and I'm living it.
Yeah. Rusty, your testimony, no, I can see the heart is full and I can listen to you the whole day and I'm sure that you have so much that you can share and tell and stories and I've got so many questions that I would like to ask you, but this is the time that we have available. You wrote a book. Tell us about the book, how it came about and also where the book can be purchased.
Okay, Yanni, the reason I wrote the book, Yanni, so in my last 2 years, I was sent to a farm prison and it was about 100 guys carefully selected to run a farm prison for the prison service. And it was all on trust. There was no bars and fences, nothing. And, I was able to get an iPhone from a mate of mine And I decided I wanted to keep memoirs of everything. And I emailed myself 700 emails of stories that had taken place so that one day I might be able to put it together. And then I didn't do anything until Mugabe was out. You know, I didn't want to, I was scared of that. And then for me, Yanni, it was about getting it all documented, the injustice of everything, because there's always questions. So I wanted people to see. And it was also very therapeutic to write it and get it down. And it's making such an impact, Yanni. And my motivational speaking, you know, I've been talking all over the place, and I've done hundreds of keynotes to corporates, and more and more I'm putting the Lord in it, because there's other incidences we don't have time to talk about it when the Lord first worked in my life, but I was 19, lost in the war, and it was very moving, but I was bulletproof. I didn't need all that, you know. That's how it was. But now, Yanni, I can see how the Lord was trying to reach me in those days. But I did a talk. Sorry, Yanni, I won't be a second. I did a talk in George the other day, and there was a Karoo farmer. And, you know, they are like proper men. Yes, and yes. I was leading it after my keynote, and he looked at me and he said, Rusty. So I said, yes, Pete. He said, you needed to go to prison for 10 years. So I said, why? He said, because the Lord needed 10 years to break into you. And I thought, wow, I did have a huge barrier around me. And, it's come down. I've surrendered totally. The Lord is in control of everything. Yeah. And I have so much peace.
Yeah. That is evident. Rusty, the name of your book, and where can people obtain it?
Beating Chains. Not breaking. Beating. Yeah. Overcoming. Beating Chains. And you can buy it anywhere, any exclusive books. Or you can purchase it on my website, which is beatingchains.com. And motivational speaking, you can book me anytime on my website, beatingchains.com. And I'll be happy to keep changing people.
I'm sure that many, many people would like to respond, not only getting in the book, but I can think of many situations, environments, communities, et cetera, where your testimony will really make such a tremendous difference. Rusty, thank you for sharing. I'm dumbstruck. I don't have words. The fact that you are alive and that you can share this testimony in itself is a miracle. It's nothing less than a miracle. When you refer to thousands of people that have died during the time that you were imprisoned, and you weren't one of them. By God's grace, you've been kept safe and reasonably well, so that you could recover and that you can be useful in God's hand. That in itself is totally incredible. There was something I wanted to ask you, I just wanted to ask you on a point of information. You wrote the book, and the book is available, and surely the book must have found its way to authorities, etc., etc. Was there any response coming from that particular situation? Say, listen, we acknowledge that the situation, the circumstances were totally inhumane. I can't even imagine when I listen to you that people can do this to other people, but it happened. Any response, any sorry, any forgive us?
Nothing. I went to Carte Blanche. I know Derek Watts. I met him a few times, and he wanted to do an article on me, but he had to get permission. So they wrote to the justice system in Zim, and they never got a reply. They forgot about me long ago, Yanni.
But God is bigger than the judicial system there. He's bigger than any prison. He's bigger than any challenge that we have to face, and your life is an example of it, is an absolute testimony of it.
I want to give you a nugget for the audience before I go, Yanni.
Please, please.
The past only exists in your head. It can only come to life if you let it. Jesus once said, can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life?
Correct, yes.
And life in prison or in Las Vegas is still just life. Mm-hmm. It's what you make of it. No matter where you are, live every moment for the pleasure of the moment. And then, Yanni, you know, I, uh, I was a wild teenager, make no mistake. And in those days during the war, you know, it was about hunting, drinking, fishing, fighting. Anything that pushed the boundaries of the law was exciting for us juveniles. Yes. Never considering the circumstances or the repercussions. But if I'd known then what I know now, my life would have been very different. Yes. And when you don't want to know what else I went through in prison.
Yes.
I had to fight for my life on many occasions, and it was by the grace of God that I got through there. Yes. Thousands didn't. Yes. And I just want to say to the audience, Yanni, that in all due respect, when you're choosing your path in the world today, choose it very carefully and the people you hang around with, because it's very easy to get mixed up with the wrong people and start pushing the boundaries of the law, especially when it comes to money, because you don't want to go where I've been. There's no mercy in prison. None. It's real and it's rough. You don't want to go there.
May those last words resonate. You don't want to go where I've been. You don't want to go where I've been. And most certainly no one wants to go there. So think about your life. Do the calculations that you need to do. Draw up a balance sheet and ask yourself whether this is worth it or whether you shouldn't just allow God to become a greater reality in your life. Nevertheless, Rusty, thank you so much. May you have a wonderful day, what's left of it. Please give my regards to your people, your family, etc., etc. We bring honor to God for having had the opportunity to listen to you. May He use you in a mighty and magnificent way, as you said, especially within situations where pastors usually would not come, will go or be invited. And may many, many people find the kingdom of God as a result of what you've shared with us today and also what you will share in the future. Thank you so much. Really do appreciate you.
Thank you, Yanni. God bless. Thank you.
That was Rusty Labuschagne with his incredible experience and testimony of God's grace amidst so much hardship. I'll have to take some time just to digest what I've heard today, and I'll have to speak to God about it. I need to have some time, just alone time, where me and God can work through what Rusty has shared with us today. Nevertheless, thank you, Zani, for attending to the technical side of this program. And once again, thank you to our listeners, Radio Pulpit and the K-Pulpit. Remember, this program is available as a podcast at www.radiopulpit.co.za. Just go to Navik Akchiel, and there you will find it, and you can share it with some other people. Thank you once again. May you have a wonderful, wonderful day, what's left of it. Till the next time, everything of the best. Bye-bye.